Good evening. Welcome to the Solaria Report. Today is Thursday, March 29th, 2012. I'm Catherine Alston-Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, we're doing something very different. We normally never have a Solaria Report in the last week of the month, but John Rappaport and I love to talk to each other, and I've learned that what we should just do is let everybody listen or record our conversations when we do. And after the last Solaria Report that John joined me for in February, we got together and we said, you know, let's just go to the movies. Let's talk about what our favorite movies are, which really help people gain insight into what's going on in the world around them. And so John and I have talked several times, and each one of us have chosen our top five movies that fit that description, and we haven't told each other what they are. So there's a little drama and mystery here, because we're gonna play movie, let's go to the movie poker. You know, one, John's the guest, so he'll put down one, I'll put down one, we'll go back and forth. And then we've also reserved, in case there's crossover, we've reserved some runner-ups, and we'll share with you what some of our runners-up are. Our theme tonight is it's all in the movies. It's amazing how much information you can glean from the movies. You just need to know, oh, that's really real and that's not. And so without any further ado, let me introduce John Rappaport, who needs no introduction, to the Solaria Report subscribers. John, welcome to the Solaria Report.
Catherine, it's great to be here, going to the movies.
Well, you are the guest. So before we start playing our movie poker, let's talk a little bit about why we want to go to the movies and sort of how we feel movies can be useful to help understand both our world and help us understand how to invent our world.
Well, of course, movies are an invention to begin with, so it's pretty fantastic to, you know, get a sense of how they're put together, what goes into creating this world on the screen that happens every time you go to the movies. But beyond that, there are some movies that kind of lift the curtain on the way the world works, the way reality operates, the way people maneuver and manipulate reality, the way the matrix is composed, so to speak. And seeing those movies more than once, usually, I find, makes a very major impression. You know, I've seen movies where the first time I was just kind of bowled over. And then I would go back and watch it again. And it was almost as if somebody was up there on the screen saying, okay, listen, I want to show you something about how the world operates. And look at this, and look at that, and think about this. Think about how that over there in the movie relates to this over here. And you're going to get some pretty important clues about the way reality is constructed for you, as opposed to the way it, quote, really is. So that would be my opener on why I think, you know, movies can really help people if they watch them in the right way.
I always thought it was a little bit of a steam valve in a couple of different ways. One is if you're running the world and it's painful, you want sympathy. So I used to have a friend who said the Soprano TV show was just a way for the, you know, the bad guys, for the organized people running organized crime to say, see, you know, it's not easy what we do. Sympathy. I think the other thing is there, you know, it's a steam valve that lets the powers that be let out information. So as long as the secret societies and intelligence agencies were doing mind control on a tightly controlled basis, they kept it under wraps. But suddenly, when lots of different intelligence agencies and organized crime and all sorts of, you know, freelancers started doing it, and the technology got to the point where machines could do it quickly, They said, people need to know this stuff exists. And suddenly you just have a spate of movies on mind control technologies. And so I think it's a way of, you know, sort of letting information out from the covert side that you can't let on explicitly. It's a way of sort of informing people when it's socially acceptable to admit that something's going on. I told you the story earlier today when I was trying to warn everybody about the mortgage fraud and the extent of the mortgage fraud, and no one would believe me. I had an old roommate from the University of Pennsylvania who called me to tell me that the Soprano TV show had just done a series on mortgage fraud. And she said to me, well, you know, if it's on The Sopranos, it must really be true. And that's when I realized, in America, fact was fiction and fiction was fact. So what's in the newspaper is fiction, and that's okay. And then, you know, what's on the Soprano TV show, that's fact. Because, in fact, if you let the fact out in fiction, then there's no criminal liability.
Because yeah, and fiction. As you say, it's kind of like a safety valve where people can sort of relax a little with it, you know, but nothing really changes. That's what a safety valve does. It sort of lets you in. Okay, you can walk through this door and we'll show you something, okay? It's sort of the classic limited hangout where you admit to something, but you never admit to the whole thing. And you feed little tidbits out here and there, and most of the time people are satisfied with that, and then you can conceal the rest.
Right. Well, the way I got to movies, you know, I was trying to explain to everybody what was going on. And what I discovered was, if you're a busy person, you know, the information is depressing enough without having to read a 1,000-page book. And what I realized is, you know, I could just use the movies. In other words, I could teach people a great deal about how the economy works, but I could do it in a way that, one, they found entertaining, and two, it helped them understand emotionally, because I can read a 1,000-page book, and I can understand intellectually, but a movie helps me walk around inside the story and feel it emotionally in a way that's much more, you know, it's sort of a compressed way of learning. It's much faster. It's much more powerful. So, you know, so I got to the point where, you know, I really started to think about, okay, what movies can help people understand, you know, sort of history and economics in a way that's a lot faster than what I got at the Wharton Business School.
I think that emotional aspect of it is very important, because when you go to the movies, what you feel, it allows you to make certain connections that you wouldn't otherwise make.
Right.
And it also allows you to see, I think, or experience contradictions that on an intellectual level you wouldn't be able to process. You would just be stuck. But when you can feel it, then you understand certain things about reality that are contradictory, and you can see them for what they are.
Right.
It's hard to do that when you're just perusing information.
Right. Okay, well, I'm dying to know what's on your list, John, so you go first.
Okay.
What's your first choice? And I should mention again, we have 5 each, so we're going to discuss 10 movies. So, John, you go first.
Yeah, well, get your breakfast ready.
Okay.
The first movie that I selected is something that I saw on television when I was, I'm going to say, maybe 14.
Uh-huh.
It's a black and white movie from 1936 called Things to Come, produced by Alexander Korda, directed by William Cameron Menzies, script by H.G. Wells, British movie, based on his novel, Wells' novel of the same name. Actually, it was The Shape of Things to Come. Starring Raymond Massey, Ralph Richardson, Cedric Hardwicke. And right out of the box, I have to say that the thing that blew me away about this movie was the set design. Because I saw this probably, I'm going to say, 1950 to 51, 52, when television was new, and special effects in movies weren't really very advanced. And yet, to this day, it stands up, because it gives you a window on a space civilization of the future, the design of which is absolutely staggering still. If you ever come across a colorized version of this, turn it off immediately, because it has to be in black and white.
Uh-huh.
That's the way it was done. And you will find people in Hollywood today, designers, set designers, even special effects people, who will rave about things to come as being not only way ahead of its time in the way it was set up and built, and I really don't know how they did it, but is still overwhelming in its scale. It gives you the sense of gigantic scale and a kind of mechanistic, automated future.
Uh-huh.
Because H.G. Wells believed in a world state. He believed in globalism. He was one of the, you might say, early modern proponents of it. And so the movie begins in 1940. War is ominous. You get a whole series of images that flash by of a dark age coming. And then there is war over London. The civilization very quickly is left in ruins. There is no technology. Sorry, there is a plague. And then there are tribes and clans of people that are scrabbling in the dirt to try to survive. And the world has gone down. There's nothing left. And then one day, a futuristic-looking plane flies overhead of one of these little crazy clans ruled by a dictator, a tin pot dictator played by Ralph Richardson. And the plane lands, and a guy gets out, and he's dressed in a sort of space suit, but he's an Earthman. And he says he's from something called Wings Over the World, that the remaining technologists who survived the war found each other and are in the process of creating a new civilization based entirely on science that will bail out everybody on the planet. Quite amazing. And
breakaway
then
civilization.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we flash forward to that world, some years in the future. And the old world is completely gone. The dark world is gone. Everything is very well lit. And as music plays, we see and hear this automated civilization operating entirely by machine. And in the center of it is this gigantic spaceship that is poised to take off. And everybody now looks like, you know, dressed in space suits and so on. Totally clean, well-lit civilization. Nations have been outlawed, and science and technology have taken over. And to me, that's, you begin to see that this is paradise with a gigantic flaw in it. Right at the center, you know, because although there are differing points of view among the elite citizenry, and you never get to see the lower classes except at the end, they have managed to convince everybody, because they have better machines, that this is the way to go. And that therefore everybody should give up their individuality and become part of the machine, which is what's happening to us now. We are being groomed and convinced for a future that is going to be managed by technocrats, and it's going to use science as the new religion. and present it as completely neutral, non-political, and everyone will fit in somewhere into it if they just surrender everything that they, you know, used to believe about themselves. And you see it here on the screen. And at the end, there's this gigantic conflict about whether to go to the moon. And all of the lower classes who still are wearing all these spacesuits try to rush the rocket and keep it from taking off. And there are two young people involved who would be the passengers. I won't even say what the ending is, but there's a certain magnificence about this because you see and you feel, you were talking about feeling before, you feel the scale of this new civilization. You feel its power. You feel that, you know, why should I maintain this stubborn kind of grungy individuality as against this beautiful machine? You can feel that. You want to be a part of it. And yet, at the same time, you realize that if you are, they're going to take everything away from you, including your memory. That this will never, right. You'll never be the same after that. And that's, to me, the brilliance of the movie, is that it really does make you think about that, make you feel it, the whole contradiction, and come to terms with it. Because now in our world, we don't get that kind of compressed chance to do that. You have to really think it out for yourself and realize where science and technology, and especially medical science, are going, and whether you want to, you know, to what degree do you want to be a part of this, and how much you want to surrender yourself, and it's all kind of piecemeal and so forth. And here in the movie, it's almost like a play on stage. You see it, you feel it. What are you going to do? Make up your mind right now, because hanging from your choice is your entire future. So I love the movie. I've seen it maybe 3 times in my life. It was the first movie I ever saw that showed me what movies could do to the imagination. That you could be just, I mean, rocketed and spiraled into a completely different reality, which is another benefit of the movie that I'm sure at that age what I began to think about was, well, what could I imagine?
Right.
Which saved me from enlisting as a slave in this world state.
Well, it's funny, the vision now is that each individual is connected through a device or a series of devices or machines, whether it's their phone and their computer, and their connection is through the entrainment and the engagement that comes electronically through the device. And they're, you know, it's the singularity is near message. They're basically, their behavior is dictated by policies that are geared into the software and the pricings, you know, in the software. And what's interesting is each person is connected into the machines through the machines instead of, so they're all resonating into the machines instead of with each other. So the whole morphogenic field, the whole resonation, the whole connectivity between people in which organic and wild things happen is shut down and controlled.
Wow. That's a fantastic insight. Wow.
Yeah. And I keep looking for movies that will show the difference between the two. You know, the difference between what happens when we resonate with each other and have a shared intelligence versus, you know, we're individually automatized through the software where we're allowed to vote in a variety of different pricings that then give the machine more information that helps it control us more. It's quite remarkable.
You know, oh boy, there's a lot to think about there. When you said that the resonance that's created by these machines shuts down the organic, wild, natural connections. That's what just kind of blew the top of my head off because it's so true. And one small example recently, when this raid happened on Rawsum Foods in Los Angeles, which is just simply a buyer's club that sells raw milk, unpasteurized milk to its members, and now this is spreading around the country, these raids, and they're vicious. Guns drawn. James Stewart, who was arrested, the head of Rawson Foods, spent three horrible days lost in the system in L.A. County Jail. Horrendous things happened to him, which I won't go into because it would take too long. But I decided, okay, so I'm going to write a piece about this, and then I'm going to start sending it out to some of the people that I remember from the old health freedom days of the early 90s, when there were lots of live events, rallies, mm-hmm. protests, conferences, meetings, all sorts of face-to-face stuff, right? And I put it on my site and I sent it out to my email list, but I also made sure to send it out to a bunch of these people from the past whom I could still find. And not one of them even answered.
Right.
And I believe that you put your finger on something here. You see, it's because it's almost like an electronic vacuum is created around the transmission of the information. It happens in this kind of empty space where the emotional impact no longer, I'm not going to say among everybody, but among people that otherwise you would think would get engaged immediately, it just isn't there. It's not part of the communication equation that's engendered by the machines that we have now.
There's a wonderful video up on the internet called Battle of Kruger, and it's some people on safari recorded a fight between four or five lions, and a large herd of water buffalo. And the lions peel off one of the baby water buffaloes and are trying to kill and eat it. And the water buffaloes get up the courage together to go attack the lions and eventually get the baby water buffalo back. But what it shows you is they're able to beat the predators once they get organized and give each other courage. And if a few people are going to control the many, then you have to find ways of making sure that the many can't sort of get together, get intelligent together, make each other intelligent, and get a lock against you.
Right.
The only way I can describe it. And I saw it when I won't go into it. We'll go into it when I get into one of the movies where I think about this. When I first saw them putting up the cell tower networks, I realized, oh, my God, they're trying to stop us from resonating with each other. You know, that's what they're afraid of. And
if the water buffalo had to email each other to say, let's get together and save the kid, you know,
right,
or on cell phones, it would be deadened.
Right. So, the shape of things to come, that's one I got to go watch that again.
Yeah, the movie is Things to Come, and then the book is Shape of Things to Come.
The book is Shape of Things to Come. Okay, so John,
card.
What? That's the card.
I said, pull out your card.
But you know what my first card is going to be.
I do. I got two ideas in my head.
Okay, the Godfather series. I'm going to do all three in one.
Oh, wow.
Is that permissible?
I didn't think of that one. Nope.
Okay. Well, The Godfather, the series was, let me give you the dates on it. It's Francis Ford Coppola directing based on a novel by Mario Puzo about a fictional mafia family, New York mafia family. And it was done in three films. The first and the most critically acclaimed came out in 1972. The Godfather, and it starred Marlon Brando as the Godfather, and then Al Pacino as one of his sons, and Robert Duvall as his adopted son, and then who played Sonny?
James Caan.
So just an all-star cast. Then the second part came out, the sequel came out in 1974, and then the last one, which in fact is my favorite, came out in 1990, 16 years later, still starring Al Pacino and Diane Keaton as the wife of the character played by Al Pacino. And what you do is you follow this New York Mafia family through the generations. So through the godfather, then through his sons, and then through, you know, their children. And so you go through three generations, and the family story is interwoven with the story of the family fortune and the wider economy, because what you see, you literally go, John, from the streets and the real estate and casino businesses that come out of the streets and sort of the concrete assets, and you rise into Washington and then into corporate investments in Wall Street and the sort of the investment world, including the Vatican Bank, and then you go all the way right to the Vatican and to the Pope. So you see the line all the way from the top of the Vatican down into the street business and the drugs. And one of the messages of this movie is, in a highly centralized model, you know, there's only one degree of separation between the streets and the top of the Vatican. In fact, it is the same place. You know, economically, there is no way. It's quite remarkable. And one of my favorite, I have many wonderful quotes, because it's also a story about power and how power can destroy a community or a family, particularly this kind of top-down power. But there are lots of great quotes in it. But one of my favorite quotes is Michael Corleone, played by Al Pacino, makes the classic mistake that I made and many other people made, which is you think if you go higher and higher in society, you can get away from organized crime, which is somehow down here on the street. So Michael keeps theorizing that, you know, he'll be more successful, he'll sell the casinos, and he'll go just reinvest the money in corporations and somehow go legitimate. And finally, in The Godfather 3, he explodes and he says, "The higher I go, the dirtier it gets."
Right.
And there's right. Another great, when Michael has sort of reached his maturity, Sonny has an illegitimate son, Vincent, Vincent Mancini, who then comes and tries to help Michael and join the business, played by Andy Garcia, and he's quite charming. And so Michael takes him when he's in Rome and Italy to meet with the Vatican Bank. They're trying to buy into a variety of different companies that the Vatican owns and controls. And so this guy whose name is Don Lucchese shows up, who's an advisor to the Vatican Bank. And Vincent says, let me just read it to you. He says, "Don Lucchese, you're a man of finance and politics. These things I don't understand." And Lucchese says, "You understand guns?" And Vincent Mancini says, "Yes." And Lucchese says, "Finance is a gun. Politics is knowing when to pull the trigger."
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
Then another one which I thought was very important was in Godfather 3, we have a sort of young guy trying to work his way up through the New York mob scene, and he's kind of a parody on John Gotti, and his name is Joey Zaza, and Vincent is constantly fighting with Joey Zaza, and Vincent says to Michael, "I'd like to take Joey Zaza up in one of these and drop him." And Corleone says, "Zaza's nothing. He's a small-time enforcer. He bluffs, threats, but nothing. You can see him coming a mile away." And Vincent says, "We should kill him before he kills us." And Michael says, "No, never hate your enemies. It affects your judgment." And later on, he says, "Our true enemy has not shown himself yet." And what you see is one of the classic tactics, and it's one I've seen a lot in my life and dealt with a lot, is they always send a small-time punk after you and try and get you to engage with the punk as opposed to the people behind the scenes who are pulling the strings. And in a highly centralized, controlled model, you know, it's very few people who are pulling the strings. And their goal is always to exercise power, so if anybody gets attacked, you know, there's 3 degrees of separation between the guy who gets blamed and the guy gets attacked by the water buffaloes and the real guy pulling the strings.
Right.
And one of the reasons I love The Godfather is it shows you, you know, one thing Michael's very good at is laying low until he sees who the true enemy is. Now, let me keep going because there are many things about this movie I love. Throughout society, there we have the overt side of the world and we have the covert side of the world. And so in any major institution like the Vatican, you know, on the front you have the church, and on the back you have this incredible endowment, which has enjoyed 2,000 years of no taxes and diplomatic immunity. And so you have you literally have two very different kinds of organizations, and most people think of the Catholic Church as a church, whereas I think of the Vatican and the Catholic Church as a major financial force and political force. So I look at it very differently. And you're one of the few people who I think has really made an effort to try and illuminate some things about the Vatican, including in the interviews. But generally, the Vatican has been untouchable in terms of really showing what's going on. And in Godfather 3, somebody, you know, there is a real effort by Hollywood to show a lot about the Vatican, and there are tremendous parallels with what went on. Let me get my notes up.
P3.
Well, you have the death of which pope was it? So in the movie, the pope is assassinated.
Right.
And you have the Vatican Bank blow up, and it's very much related to, the real parallels to the death of, who was it, Pope John, and the huge scandal in the Vatican Bank.
Right.
So this is the first time, to my knowledge, Hollywood really takes you up and starts dishing the dirt out on what's arguably the most powerful institution in the world.
I thought so. I wanted to see that movie many times, Godfather 3. Because it was, in terms of the information they were delivering, by far the richest of any of the three movies, Godfather
right.
movies. Immobiliari, the giant Vatican construction company, was brought into it, and sort of vaguely alluded to the P3 scandal. What was his name? Jelly, it was his last name. An Italian politician was all wrapped up in that. Roberto Calvi, who was found hanged from the London Bridge in London.
Right.
All of these incredible things that were splashed all over the press in Europe and barely even really covered in America were happening like crazy over there. And I don't recall any other movie that's ever attempted to even allude to any of this, you know, in a realistic way. But you know
what
now,
got me to watch Godfather 3?
What?
We had, in 1998, a reporter wrote a story about what I was dealing with on the litigation that ricocheted all over the internet, and I got a call from somebody who I would describe as highly placed in the Council on Foreign Relations, and the message was, don't blame us, it's not our fault, you have to see Godfather 3. You know, and it And my interpretation of that after watching Godfather 3 was he was saying, look, you know, all the real estate deals you were messing with are controlled by the Vatican. Don't blame us. It's not our fault. Don't blame Harvard. It's really the Catholics. Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think there are a couple, just to sum it up on the Godfather story, there are a couple of sort of important morals of the story that I take from it. One is there, you know, the street and the top is one place in a centralized model. If you're harvesting every neighborhood with the drugs or lottery or whatever, you can't afford to make an exception to the rule. Because if an exception can happen in your neighborhood, then it can happen in every neighborhood. And what's incredible is how carefully the top watches the money in every place. I'll never forget when I first moved down to Tennessee, I had about $6,000 in cash, and I was putting it in a safe deposit box that I'd just gotten at this little bank, you know, in the county here where I live. And the president of the bank, who I'd never met, was in his office. I walked into the safe deposit room. He jumped up, shot into the safe deposit room, and kept trying to look over my shoulder to see what I was putting in the safe deposit box.
Really?
Yeah, and I said, well, I guess the boys, I guess moving to Tennessee is not getting away. You know, so I always say there is no way. But that's how tightly related, you know, whether it's Washington or Wall Street, that the cash flows are very tightly managed from top to bottom. The other thing you see is the extent to which the at one point Michael Corleone says, when they come at you, they come at those you love, or they come at that which you love. And one of the things you see is the family get torn apart by the power politics, different people vying for power, try and play people inside the family against each other. And right. And you literally see power break down the family over the generations. And, you know, if there's a message in this for me, it's if you're a man and a woman, do not let the power players get in between you and play you against each other. Because the, you know, the key to building family wealth is to keep the trust and loyalty inside within the family and not get played by the outsiders. So, and another message.
That's another one. You know, the sense to me in Godfather 3 also is at the top, if you try to make nice, neat categories, you'll fail. You say, well, this is corporate, this is government, this is church, this is, you know, highly organized church like Vatican, this is, you know, whatever. It just isn't going to work because those people are not really thinking in those terms.
No, not at all.
And it's only, you know, those people who are trying to fathom the situation looking at these categories that are misled and led astray. I remember Robert Anton Wilson once wrote something like, the political left hates corporations. The political right hates government. They're both correct. But if you see how that plays out on the political landscape, of course, they're battling each other as if they're really talking about completely different things. And that one is, of course, more correct than the other. And, you know, they're arguing back and forth and back and forth. But at the top, the money, the power, those categories don't exist at all.
Right. Though all those institutions are just machineries. And so, for example, if you were to get into different kinds of groups that you've talked about, so if you were to go into the, you know, into the Mason Lodge, or you were to go into the Bilderbergers, you've got somebody, you know, representing all the different institutions, and you talk about, okay, where do we want to go and how are we going to get there? Then how do we engineer it so everybody makes money getting there? And then, you know, everybody goes back into the machinery and proceeds to turn the ships to, you know, to then set sail for wherever they decided to go. And it's funny, one of the frustrating things for me is, you know, when I started to try and explain to people how things work, they say, oh, well, you could never get those 20 institutions to all act in concert together. That would be too hard and complicated. I said, wait a minute. You know, one representative of every one of those institutions is over at the lodge on Wednesday night, and they all agreed that's what they were going to do. But they don't. They think of those the way we think of cars. You know, so you all go back and get in your car and drive it around. But and that's your position, you know, and that's your vehicle, but that's not who you are. You're part of a group that has a higher identity. You know, whether it's the family or the secret society or whatever it is. And you know, you don't think in terms of loyalty to institutions. That's something you give to the water buffalo so they'll operate your machine for you.
You know, when I did some of the interviews that became The Matrix Revealed, one of the things that came out several times was whenever we'd get into the medical cartel, and you could even extend that to mean technology, 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 the emphasis that I got from the insiders was, as these people at the top mesh and they evolve and they see common interests, in more lucid form, and they begin to cooperate on deeper and deeper levels to bring about the future that they want. What the medical cartel is basically doing, and that includes technology, is arguing their case and saying, we're very important to you people because you can operate under our cover, because we represent no flag, no nation, no political party, nothing partisan, nothing that even smells of partisanship. You do want to build a super technological world, this we know. You're heading there already. And we can help you. But we want to be in on the main conversations at the main table because we're that important. We can influence gigantic numbers of people. We can debilitate gigantic numbers of people through pharmaceuticals. We can do all kinds of things, genetic engineering, et cetera, et cetera. Let's look ahead a little bit further than you may be looking, and let's look at what the vision is of the future, and you'll see that we really belong here. And this is how I would tie together these two first films that we're talking about that seem so different. As the future unravels and unrolls here, technology, super technology, world state run by technocrats over and against, you know, big money, big corporations, gigantic religious organization like the Vatican, mob, drugs, money, gangsters, et cetera, et cetera. They, in fact, are all feeding together in the same stream in their attempt to exercise control.
Right. It's a living system.
That's right.
Right. And the goal of the more power you have, the more invisible you want to be. And you stay invisible by not allowing people to see it as a dynamic living system. You know, so you have them in the finance box, or you have them in the health box, or you have them in the religious, you know, you organize the knowledge around cartels and in ways that they can't integrate it and see it as a living system. Because if you can see it as a living system, then you can find the trim tabs. You can find those lever points where you can start to impact where the system goes. Which is what our goal is, John.
Yeah.
to have everybody see those trim tabs and to see it as a living system. Okay, so what's your number two?
My number two movie is from 1988, directed by John Carpenter, written by John Carpenter, They Live.
Ooh, that's on my list.
I figured it must be.
Yeah.
Starring
okay,
Roddy
so.
Piper and Keith David. Roddy Piper, of course, was a professional wrestler that was brought in by John Carpenter, who took one look at him and said, this is my guy. He made some comment about him. You could see life written all over him. And that's what I wanted for this main character. This is definitely a B movie. It really doesn't pretend to be anything else. It wasn't a high budget movie. But that plays into its success in terms of bringing the viewer the stark terms of mind control. You have the reality, which nobody understands, talk about invisibility. The ruling class on the planet are really aliens from somewhere else, from another dimension, another space, another planet, whatever. But nobody knows that. And you don't know that.
They're mean people. They're just mean.
Pardon?
They're mean.
Yeah.
They're cranky and they're mean.
And they are running their operation called Planet Earth through a TV signal on top of a TV station that hides the subliminal messages that they are placing in media, which means radio broadcast, television broadcast, billboards, newspapers, etc., whatever. And these subliminals are words and phrases like obey, consume, marry and reproduce, no independent thought. And then there's one that shows money. I think it's a $100 bill. And on that is written, this is your God. And so Roddy and Keith eventually team up because Roddy, who's poor, is just kind of a drifter. And there are people living in the bad side of town that he kind of hangs with. And, you know, he finds inside a church, a weird church where there's music playing and it seems like there would be a, you know, service going on, but there's nobody there. He finds boxes that contain these special sunglasses. And when he puts them on after being staggered, he eventually discovers that he can see the aliens that are walking around.
And he can see the subliminal messages.
And he can see the subliminal messages.
Yeah.
Right. And eventually when he confronts some of the aliens near the end of the movie, he has the classic line, I have come here to chew bubble gum and kick ass, and I'm all out of bubble gum. Right? That's the line that survived from the B-movie script, right?
Uh-huh.
And so why don't you pick it up from here, because since we both have it on our lists, you should talk about it too.
There's a great book that I love called Political Ponerology, and it's and in it it describes a thesis where you it says you have 5% of the people who are psychotic and are perfectly capable of organizing and doing things that are harmful to the human race. And then you have about 20% who are happy to make money serving the 5% who end up taking control. It's a political ponerology is the study of evil as it works through political mechanisms. And then 75% of the people can't fathom that the other 5% or 20%, you know, exist and are willing to behave that way. And yet when they discover, you know, when the system is finally explained to them, they can start to organize to protect themselves. And the thing I love about They Live is you've got a percent of the population who, from the human point of view, are basically psychotic. You know, that they are behaving in ways that are very damaging and harmful to the humans. But the humans can't see them. They can't see who's a good guy and a bad guy. They can't see how the system works. And then you've got another 20% or some group of humans which are happy to do their bidding. So we have the scene, I don't remember if the sort of their group of humans in the party and some, this big sort of fat corporate looking guy says to the protagonist, he says, oh, listen, play along with them. They take care of you. It's great. Do you remember that scene?
Yeah. And that's the most telling part of the movie is that you see these, you know, fairly wealthy earthlings who are living the good life that you would ordinarily say, well, they're at the top of the ladder. See, but they're really only the servants of the bad ones, the aliens. And they do that very well. I mean, you feel it. You experience it. You say, oh, my God, you know, yeah. They're just servants, really, when you strip away the nonsense.
Right. And they're perfectly willing to go along. You know, I think it's hard for many people to fathom that guys like that are perfectly happy to put mercury and other poisons into babies and make them autistic just to go along and get along.
You bet.
You know, and they think that's great because look how much money they're making. So, but you see that, you feel that. And I think the reason I like They Live is you can see the 5%, you can see the 20%, you can see the 75%. And the message is, you know, we do have people running around behaving, you know, we do have this group who's psychotic for whatever reason. I'm always telling people, you know, they might as well be aliens. So just, you know, it's in a way it's okay to think of some of these people as aliens because they might as well be aliens. They're, you know, they don't think of themselves as the same species. They think of you and me the way we think of chickens. And so there's not this empathy. You know, so we have this group without empathy. We have another group happy to serve them as long as it makes them money. And what I like about They Live is it gives you a metaphor where you can see that dynamic clearly. That's number one. Number two, because of the Entrainment that's coming out from the TV station, you know, I think Entrainment is having a very serious impact on our society. I think it's very real, and we've done Solari reports about Entrainment. But in They Live, you see, you know, a metaphor of Entrainment just having a dramatic impact on the control of society. So I like that part about it. And I like the notion of what people need are sunglasses, because we're talking about a system which is very invisible. The control systems are very, very invisible. You and I have spent a lifetime trying to unpack them and understand them and figure out how to communicate them. But what I want to know more than anything is, how can I build a time-effective way for every subscriber to the Solari Report to get a pair of sunglasses?
That's it.
That's it.
And that, of course, at the end, the hero, Roddy Piper, finds a way to disconnect and destroy the signal.
Right.
At which point, everybody can see the truth. And they
do. They wake up.
They wake up. They can see what he could only see with sunglasses. And that's also a very powerful metaphor, that waking up really does mean something. Because when you see what's going on, then you can change, and you will change what you do. It's not just something you notice. And they make it very vivid in the movie in very stark terms. I mean, everything is defined, you know, very starkly here. So it isn't like you've got to wade through the nuances. You know, when John Carpenter makes a movie, you don't have to wonder who the bad guys and the good guys are. You know, it's right out there.
Right.
So, and Roddy Piper is a very sympathetic character. I mean, he's great. He doesn't seem to have any reason for doing what he's doing except just basic human outrage at what he discovers. He's not a philosopher in particular. Far from it. He's an action guy.
Just a good guy.
Just a good guy who finds out
guy.
The truth. And now he's not willing to step away, regardless of the odds. It's that simple and stark, again.
Yeah, he maintains his courage in the land of giants. When I first saw They Live, I said, that is the weirdest movie I've ever seen. And then I noticed year after year me saying, you know, it just keeps getting weirder. It just keeps getting weirder. And then finally, I don't know, about 4 years ago, I said, you know, this is really beginning to feel like They Live.
Yeah.
You know, and every year They Live seems less weird because the world is getting progressively weirder. So
sure
if you
is.
Watch They Live, just get ready for a really weird movie.
Oh, yeah. You definitely.
Okay, so you ready for my next one?
Please. You're
okay.
Number two.
This is the only Serbo-Croatian produced movie we will discuss. It's a 1980 Yugoslav biographical film called The Secret of Nikola Tesla. And it's have you seen this one?
No.
This was not a bestseller, I assure you. But here's the interesting thing. J.P. Morgan is played by Orson Welles. Thomas Edison is played by Dennis Patrick. George Westinghouse is played by Strother Martin. And it's a Yugoslav character that plays Nikola Tesla. And it's the story of Tesla and of J.P. Morgan financing him and then essentially destroying him and everything. Westinghouse from Pittsburgh trying to save Tesla and keep him going, and Edison competing. And it's quite, you know, it's. I don't think it brings anything new to the story that everybody already knows about Tesla. But you see, it's a wonderful movie because you see two things. One is you see this extraordinary intuitive genius in Nikola Tesla, and this kind of plotter who's very angry and is happy to steal all of Tesla's work and try and help destroy him in Edison. Of course, we've all grown up with the history books persuading us that Edison is this great genius, and he's really not. He's the guy who helped J.P. Morgan steal everything and commercialize it. And then you see the importance to the financial model of suppression of technology. Because Tesla wants to make free energy available. And of course, Morgan doesn't want anything that can't be metered. And you watch the tension between science that wants to go free and a financial model that wants to suppress technology. And one of the things I find, John, one of the reasons I chose this is I think it's hard for most people to fathom the extent to which our current economic model controls what technology is allowed and what's not, and the amount of time and money and effort that's been put into suppressing extraordinary amounts of technology and making sure that what's adapted is designed to finance the, you know, a set group of characters who really control and manage the economy. And the secret of Nikola Tesla, if you had any illusions that we operate in a market economy, it will make it very, very clear to you that that is absolutely not the case.
Wow. Yeah. You know, one of the things that this makes me think of is futures that could have been.
Right.
Still can be, but at the time turn into futures that could have been. And I've had several experiences in my life that were really enlightening along those lines. Maybe two. Take too long to go into them. But the gist of all of them was I came up with an idea, and when I fleshed it out for a project, I saw how it could be done, where it could be done, and who I would have to convince to make it happen. And inevitably what I ran into, because, and this I think is a key to Tesla, because I was naive about the way the world works, I decided that I would put it in front of the person who could decide to make it happen, and that that would be the acid test for whether or not this future was going to come into being. I mean, when you're in the middle of something like this, it's not hard to think that way. You know, if you're an inventor, for example, and you just come up with something fantastic, and you know who you've got to put it in front of, and if they say yes, the world changes. Well, right. You're going to try to do that. I mean, it's a natural impulse to go there. But at the same time, it's not as if you put all your eggs in that basket, no matter what anybody says, you're naive. You just don't understand how the world operates. And so when I did that, of course, I got turned down for very, stupid reasons that were either egotistical on the part of the decision maker, or it was somebody that just really wanted to stop something from happening because he was essentially a low-level operative of something much larger, and he just knew what he had to do, and he did it. But at the moment when the decision was made against me, I saw, you know, like I'm looking at my desk right here, the other possible future drift by. The future in which the project did get off the ground, reality changed, a different future was created. And it was so clear to me that it led me into some major contemplation, shall we say, over a period of years to unravel that whole experience and figure it out. What does that mean? And then, of course, I came to the conclusion, what it means, my boy, is that you've got to take this to people. You've got to take it to people who are real human beings. You've got to do it yourself. You've got to get people to join in if you want something that important to happen, and not, for God's sakes, rely on the very institutions that are dedicated to a future in which this can't happen. But this happens over and over again, and it happened with Tesla. Happened with Tesla because he grew up in a simpler time when it was harder to imagine that you could go outside the boundaries of these institutions and get anything done. But this is big. I mean, Tesla is a prime example.
You see a society in where you have people in a higher mind and people in a lower mind, and the people in the lower mind are consistently killing off the people in a higher mind and getting away with it.
That's a clue.
I mean, if you just go back over the last 50 years and say, okay, who was assassinated?
Right.
You're looking at the higher-minded people. You know, the people who are killing them are people who are lower-minded and jealous. And, it's quite extraordinary. I'll never forget when I worked for in the Bush administration. Finally, one day, the secretary called me in, as Jack Kemp, and he said he was having one of his true confession moments. We used to have these. And, in fact, I recorded all my history of the working for Kemp, and it's called the Kemp Tapes. It's up on the blog. And Kemp said, aren't you angry at me? I said, Jack, why would I be angry at you? He said, I steal all your ideas. I said, Jack, I work for you. My job is to come up with ideas that you can use. And he said, but I steal all your great ideas. I said, but Jack, I'll just invent new ones. And
wow.
He looked at me as though he hated me more than any person alive. It was pure hatred. And my attitude was, hey, if you want an idea, just invent another. You know, I'll invent 20. It's kind of like it's an infinite thing.
Perfect.
What's the problem?
Perfect.
And yet, you know, you see that in the Tesla movie. One of my favorite documentaries is the one on Royal Rife. Same thing. You're talking about somebody who has the power to create and invent on an endless scale. An unending scale. And the people who can't do that and want to control, just it drives them crazy. And there's a beautiful scene in the Tesla movie where Morgan and Edison are sort of giving Tesla a hard time because he figures these things out with intuitive visions. And that means he's not a hard worker. And they try and make him feel like he's, you know, weird because he has these intuitive flashes. And you see the sort of age-old battle between the, you know, the intuitive and the explicit knowledge. It's very... Anyway, so that's one I recommend to you, John, The Secret of Nikola Tesla.
It's on my
list. Okay, your turn.
Okay, well, I'm going to skip ahead to another one of mine out of sequence here because of what we're talking about now. And I have to confess, it's not a great movie, but I've got to talk about it anyway. 1949, Gary Cooper, Patricia Neal, Raymond Massey, directed by King Vidor, The Fountainhead. Script by Ayn Rand, from the novel by Ayn Rand. Now, I know a lot of people have problems with Ayn Rand, and a lot of people are what you would call lockstep robotic devotees of Ayn Rand. As is usual with some major figure, you get both sides, neither of which is really on the money as far as I'm concerned. I've read her two big novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, I don't know, probably three times each. Finally got to the end of Atlas Shrugged once, all the way through. I have a lot of sympathy for the woman, a lot of empathy, because I'm willing to overlook what turn out to be, let's call it, literary problems with the books as you read further and further into them, and you begin to get the sense that maybe the kind of freedom that she's promoting is really being sabotaged by the way she presents her characters interacting with each other and the way she keeps harping on the same themes over and over again until that becomes grinding. And then you say, and she's the one who's talking about freedom. So it's a bit self-defeating, but she's a brilliant thinker. When it comes to presenting the difference between collectivism and individuality, you would be very hard-pressed to find somebody better than she to explain it all. And the movie, she had some problems with the movie, although she did write the script. And the movie is not as bad as it could have been. Gary Cooper plays it well. Patricia Neal, who's an unusual actress, plays it well. Some of the key scenes are played well. But the thing that a lot of devotees of Ayn Rand forget about The Fountainhead, which to me is by far her greater novel of the two, is that the key character, Howard Roark, who is an architect, is an artist. He's a creator. This is what he does. So it isn't simply that Roark is battling for his freedom in a collectivist world, which is sort of the theme of the book and the theme of the movie. It's that he is so immune from whatever is happening in the world around him that he can create the vision that he wants to create and make it come true, regardless of what anybody thinks, says, or does. And in that, and you see some glimpses of that in the movie, in that, I would say that in the history of movies, he is the one character who expresses that more, far more than anybody else. Far more than anybody else. And basically, for anybody who doesn't know the story, to sum it up, he comes from an architecture school where they kick him out just before he graduates. He goes to New York and he works through a number of low-level jobs, but all the time you understand that this is a man of extraordinary talent who will never be shunted aside or derailed into compromise because he wants to build the buildings he wants to build. And he will. And he will find people, or people will find him, who wants him to do that. And he is offset in both the novel and the movie by other characters who in one form or another represent the collective. Peter Keating, who is his college friend, sort of, who becomes famous as an architect because he caves in at the slightest opportunity and is also highly insecure. Ellsworth Toohey, who is a newspaper columnist who begins to wield an enormous amount of cultural influence over the entire elite of the nation, by being the embodiment of what collectivism is, and yet Toohey is apart from it, knows what he's doing, though he would never admit it. And the scene that you describe between you and Jack Kemp is mirrored in the book and in the movie. Because Toohey hates Howard Roark. Because Howard Roark is an infinite fountain of new ideas and new creations. And Toohey has nothing or can't find it in himself to create anything at all. And so this is what Ayn Rand describes as a second-hander philosophy, where people who have nothing simply either steal from those who can create, or they set out to destroy them because they are so jealous, envious, and they see reflected from the people who really can create in majestic ways their own ugly image in the mirror. And so they must destroy them. And in a brilliant stroke, and it's played fairly well in the movie and extremely well in the novel, the woman whom Roark falls in love with, Dominique Francone, is well aware of Roark's talent. She has enormous perception. And she decides that the only thing that can save this man whom she loves and adores is to destroy any possibility that he will ever make any progress as an architect in the city of all architecture, which is New York, because she reasons that if he is exposed to the vicious elements of collectivism around him, they will find a way to destroy his talent and kill him. And she eventually tells him so, and tells him that she is going to set out to bar him from any opportunity that he might be able to get. And he looks at her, and he laughs. And he says, go ahead. You'll eventually come back to me. and I'm willing to wait no matter how long it takes until you realize that basically nothing is going to deter me. Nothing and no one. And that's the theme of the movie. And the movie shows you enough of it to get the hit, to get the hit of what that is. And it's exactly as you said, Catherine. The person who can really create, imagine and create a new future for himself, a new world, a new whatever it is, anywhere on the spectrum. The lie is that that person only has a finite supply of new creations, when the truth is it's infinite. It's totally endless, limitless, and that's what makes that person free. That is what keeps that person free.
Right, because they can always build a picture of the world they want to be in.
And if somebody tries to take part of that away from them, they can say, yeah, okay, well, I can either fight you or I can let you go because, you know, I got a million of these, Jack. Like you said. I got a million.
One of my favorite preachers has a great sermon that I love. He says, look, my elevator only goes to the first floor. If you want to go to the basement, you're just going to have to get off.
Right. Right. So I bring in that movie now because of what you said, before, because I think it's very important. And this is where movies, you know, they can galvanize you. I mean,
right.
If you hadn't read the novel and you went to see The Fountainhead and you had kind of an open mind, you would be staggered simply because you'd never seen anything like this before. A man and a woman who are, I mean, attracted to each other beyond, what you would think is possible, and yet become adversaries, or she becomes his adversary, based on the idea that she knows who he is and believes that the world will destroy him, therefore she has to keep him a failure. And he says to her, no matter. I know exactly what you're doing. I know why you're doing it. Go ahead and do it. I want you to do it because you have to get it out of your system. And once you do, you'll come back to me because you'll have the confidence in knowing that I can't be destroyed.
There was a
and
great
in
moment.
That kind of dialogue, we see the kind of world that can actually be created by people, by us.
Right. There was a great moment in last year when I was talking to Bill Tiller, and he was explaining about the importance of coherence of each person to the creation of a coherent intention or field. And shortly thereafter, I talked to Foster Gamble about the documentary he made, Thrive. Mm-hmm. And in it, he comes out very hard about the importance of non-violation of each person and the sanctity of individual rights. And I asked him where he was taking the most criticism on. Was it on UFOs? And he said, no, it's on the sanctity of individual rights. And because so much of the spin around the guys who run things understand that if you can make an individual coherent, then you can control the whole thing. You know, if each individual water buffalo is incoherent, they can't get together and protect the baby water buffalo.
That's right.
Right.
That's absolutely
so,
right.
That's why this issue of the individual and their ability to create is so important.
And you
okay, you ready for my next one?
I am.
Okay.
Lead it out.
Okay. I love the movies that George Clooney makes. So my next one is Syriana. And you've seen Syriana.
I have.
Okay. It's a 2005 geopolitical thriller is what it's called, and the executive producer is George Clooney, who also plays one of the CIA agents in it, and so I think he won Best Supporting Actor for it. And it's an interesting film. It's about the geopolitics, the Middle East, we have an American corporation who's trying to position themselves to control politics in the Middle East, and you see a competition between the Americans and the Chinese trying to insert themselves into the governance structure of the country in question. And the CIA is operating covert operations, and in the middle of it you have a young investment analyst played by Matt Damon, who is based in Switzerland, and comes and ends up being an advisor to one of the brothers, who's on the sort of side of developing the country. And the reason I choose it is, first of all, if you ever worked on Wall Street and you've made a whole variety of investment banking calls in situations like this, it feels exactly like what it felt like. You know, I watch Sirion and I think, oh, I've lived this movie. I've been to this movie in several of the scenes that the Matt Damon character is playing. But the other thing is Matt Damon is pushing the Arab prince to develop his country and lift his people out of poverty. And the guy blows up and explains to the naive Matt Damon that he's not allowed to. You know, that in fact he's required by the powers that be to spend lavishly on luxury goods but not spend a dime on lifting anybody out of poverty, that in fact it's being dictated top down what may and may not go on in terms of economic development. And it's funny, sometimes I really feel like giving this movie to environmentalists and saying, you know, poverty is a plan to keep the carbon footprint down, because you really see how the model works. And you see a lot about the politics of oil. There are a couple of very funny scenes when people say, you know, corruption is what makes the economy work. One of the plots is that the oil company has been bribing officials, and this is causing both political and legal problems, and that sort of comes out. Anyway, it's a bit of an uncomfortable movie, but it really takes you inside the global model where we print dollars. They go down in value, but in the meantime we extract natural resources for cheap, and that is what sort of makes the system go. And if you get inside the machinery and see how this model of extracting natural resources works, it's very, very ugly, and it depends on force. And in fact there's a scene in the movie where we see Langley basically send in a missile and kill the Arab prince. So you really understand how literally we have a global model that runs taxation, whether it's extraction of natural resources or forcing people to buy the dollar and not develop their people, instead invest the capital back into big, you know, stocks of big U.S. corporations. You see how the United States can literally enforce anywhere in the world because they have satellites and they have missiles and can operate covertly in a way that controls and very much determines the governance in each country. Anyway, so that's my next one, Syriana. Any okay. Comments, John?
Yeah, you bet. It is an uncomfortable movie. The thing about the Arab prince reminds me of a story that was told to me, I'm going to say, about 30 years ago, from two separate sources that didn't know each other. Both were refugees from Iran who came here after the Shah was deposed and the Ayatollah took over. And if people ever followed that history, one of the very weird things about it was, why did it happen? How did it happen? Because the Shah was obviously our guy. He was a CIA guy. He was an American guy. And as vicious as he was, he was running a society that, in which he was attempting to expand the economy. And
right,
both of
he was trying to lift people up.
He was. While he was having his people torture other people, so it was definitely a mixed bag. But Here was the story in a nutshell told to me by two different people. At some point, the Shah decided that because he had the oil, he was going to build the biggest plastics factory in the world. And he was going to become a major trading partner with Europe. And this was going to be the future of his country. And the overthrow of the Shah and the rise of the Ayatollah was an operation in which the powers that be basically said to the Shah, that's not permitted. On the planetary chessboard, that's not the way your country is supposed to operate. We don't want that. It's not going to happen. And so when you look at what happened when the Ayatollah came in, his assigned mission after he had been languishing in Paris for a number of years and they brought him back was to take the country back in the direction of the Stone Age. And that's what he did. And that's precisely analogous to the story that you're telling from Syriana.
Right.
Same idea.
Right. Basically what this guy's saying is, you know, the global governance has determined that we will live in the Stone Age. And
right.
I have no choice.
Exactly. That's it.
And Matt Damon doesn't believe it, but by the end of the movie...
he does.
A fair amount of violence, he does.
Yeah,
he gets
fair amount. I think I'm convinced now that, Exactly, see. And that's the way that game works. That's the way that game operates. Just as you say, you know, you create the money, you use the money for the natural resources. You can look at many operations going on these days in the same vein, including the operation that some people call AFRICOM, to bring in the U.S. military into Africa with the idea of spearheading further corporate, mega corporate, multinational corporate intrusion onto the continent to reap the benefits of natural resources all over the place. And in the process to, decimate things even further than they are now. And any various humanitarian projects that are supposed to be all for the purpose of doing good, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, give the rationale for this to happen. Same idea. Your country
right.
has been designated to be the following, and that's what we're going to make it into. And the public face may be, we're going to save you from AIDS, we're going to give you food, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. But the point is to gain an entree and then to use that to expand and then bring in the military, the corporate people, CIA, et cetera. And this isn't just an American operation. I mean, other countries are involved too. And just carve up the whole thing.
Right. Right. And you see and feel that in Syriana. It gives you a sense of the different players. There's once, when they're deciding to go to war, they have a committee to save the country. And you
yeah.
take one look at this committee and you think, oh my God, these are
yeah.
subsidy-seeking, you know, animals if you've ever seen them. Okay, your next one, John. Your last
okay.
one.
Okay. I'm going to shift the mood to a comedy. 1941,
wow.
directed by Howard Hawks, perhaps the greatest comedy director of all time, starring Cary Grant, Roz Russell, Ralph Bellamy, His Girl Friday. Every time I see this movie, I just want to jump out the window and fly because it elevates the human spirit in a very unusual way. In a very unusual way. Well, first of all, lots of it is improvised. And Hawks said, go for it. Roz Russell, who is a brilliant comedian, was the last choice to do this. Carol Lombard, Katharine Hepburn, I mean, any one of them would have been good. She was just unimaginable. And she didn't like her part because she thought it was too small. And so when she got the okay to improvise, she had her own writers, you see, write lines for her. And so she put them in as they were doing the scenes. And Carrie knew this was happening, and so he would say things to her on the set like, you know, did you bring one of your writers with you today, you know? The mood was absolutely marvelous. The story was essentially, Cary Grant is the editor of a New York newspaper. Everybody talks very fast in this movie. I mean, the dialogue is overlapping. They're talking over each other all the time. Roz Russell is his ex-wife, ace reporter on the paper, who has now decided to leave, to get away from it all. She's sick of it. She's sick of him and his manipulating style, because she wants to marry him, and he keeps finding ways to put her off and get her onto assignments and this and that, which she loves because she's a dyed-in-the-wool old-time reporter. And so he's just bamboozled her one too many times, and so she's now going to marry the young Ralph Bellamy, a completely naive schlemiel from, I think it's Albany, no, not upstate New York, maybe Binghamton, who's an insurance salesman, who's a real nice, sweet guy, a real rube who knows nothing about the big city, and he comes down to get her. And so as she's about to leave, there's a gigantic story that comes up about the execution of Earl Williams, convicted for murder. And it's got to be covered. It's big stuff, the execution, and all these hard-boiled reporters, you know, who've seen everything. They want to get into the execution, and what are the last few hours going to be like, and this and that and the other thing. And so Carrie sets about to bamboozle her once again and bring her into the story, postpone her wedding to Ralph, and to also completely get Ralph so screwed up that he doesn't know which way is up and which way is down, which he does by getting him arrested several times over and over by the cops for little things that he didn't do that Ralph just can't simply understand. And all the while this is all happening, the dialogue is so fast and so funny, and you can see that the characters are enjoying themselves so much, especially Carrie, because Roz is just as quick as he is, and he's lightning fast. So for every move he makes, she's got a counter. And as they're rapping back and forth faster and faster, you can see him actually grin and go out of character, because he's appreciating her brilliance so much in being able to match him step for step. Everybody is having a grand time. And the thing that really gets me about, and eventually, of course, what happens at the end is they prove that Earl is innocent, shouldn't be put to death at all, and then some crooked politicians have to pay the price for that, because they were counting on this execution to get them elected, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And so finally, Ralph Bellamy slinks off back to his home, because he says, I just can't do this, and you're not for me, and you know you're not for me. You belong here. And she doesn't say anything, and he leaves. And at the end, she says to Carrie that she'll stay if he'll marry her. And he says, of course I'll marry you. I've been in love with you ever since I saw, you know, back and forth, my darling, and this and that. And we'll go on a honeymoon, and we'll take the train through Albany, and this and that. And of course, as it turns out, Carrie knows very well that there's some gigantic strike going on in Albany, and they're going to stop off there on the way on their honeymoon, and, you know, who knows what's going to happen at that point on, right? But the spirit of this is so high and so beautiful and so fast and so improvised and so creative and so imaginative that you see, I was talking earlier about, you know, alternative futures, alternative realities. You sit and watch this, you experience it, you feel it, you know that life could be lived at another level.
Right.
And that's the beauty of it. You know it in your bones once you see this thing. And you walk out of it feeling, maybe, you know, I could imagine my life completely differently. Just find something that I haven't been able to quite see before, and that would be the key that would unlock my imagination. And then I would not only live to invent a different future, but in inventing it, my whole emotional makeup would change, and I would be more of what I really am, which is free, excited, ecstatic, alive. That's what this movie does to me.
It's funny you should bring this up. I just watched Annie Mame again last week.
Oh, yeah.
Last weekend. And it's Rosalind Russell, and she's playing a character who believes she can invent her world again and again and again. And she's always getting irritated at people who think small or think little.
Yeah.
And conspiring to, you know, outwit them. And it's the same feeling. It's just, and you watch it, and it takes me back to, you know, a world 20 or 30 years ago when people felt far less constrained and far more, there's much more afraid. Before 1996, you used to constantly hear the expression, hey, it's a free country. And suddenly in 1996, people stopped saying it.
Right.
You know, and it really has cut down on the spirit of things. But I love going back and watching the old movies, including the Cary Grant movies, because you're in a world where people really do think that life should be grand.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And it should.
And there's nothing to stop them. I mean, it's not
right.
Sure, there's conflict and so on, but you know from the beginning that vision is going to win out because that's the way these people are.
Right. It's funny because I worked on Wall Street and the competition was brutal and the work was stressful, but there was no excuse not to be, not to have fun and not to, you know, to be grand, you know,
exactly.
Think big. Anyway, so, well, that's a good pick, John. Okay, ready for my last one?
Hit it.
Or my last one minus the one we shared? My fourth one is Battlestar Galactica, the TV series.
Wow.
Now, have you seen the whole TV series?
No, I haven't. I've seen some episodes, but never really grasped the whole thing.
Well, we had an intern at Solari, and if you had said to me, let's watch Battlestar Galactica, I would have said, are you out of your mind? I would never. Well, David Lichty, you know, pulled it out, and he started, I mean, he said, just watch the first one. And I got completely hooked. And I finally had to buy the whole series because I just didn't want to wait for Netflix. And we literally, over a couple-month period, sat down and watched every one, you know, in order. And it's a story. You start off with the humans being part of the civilization of humans live in a series of planets known as the 12 colonies. And at one point, the humans created a race of cybernetic robots called the Cylons who've evolved and now look like humans. And they were in a war and arrived at a peace treaty, and then all of a sudden, for reasons we won't go into, we'll let you see the series, the Cylons launch a sneak attack that basically destroy everyone except 50,000 people who survive and organize around one Battlestar, the Battlestar Galactica, which has not been destroyed. Interestingly enough, the Battlestar Galactica has legacy systems that are not worked into the network, and so they can't be destroyed. You know, a little comment on the importance of diversification in your systems.
Yeah.
And the Battlestar Galactica is under the leadership of a fleet officer whose name is Adama, William Adama, Bill Adama, who's played by the Edward James Olmos. And interestingly enough, the civilian government, the now, you know, everybody dies down in line to, I think, the 27th or 37th as line, is the Secretary of Education, played by Mary McDonnell, who now qualifies under the line of succession to be the president. And she's President Laura Roslin. And so you have the civil government run by this woman and the military government run by the man. And much of the story is of this small fugitive fleet of humans trying to escape the Cylons and find a new place to live. And eventually they find a new planet called Earth. It's funny, the original writer of the original Battlestar Galactica was a Mormon. It was created by Glenn Larson, and it who was a Mormon, and some people think a lot of it came from the Book of Mormon. And the guy who got me to watch it, in fact, was a Mormon, so it was very interesting. There are many, the only way I can describe this is it is Shakespearean. It gets into all the big issues, life, death, love, hate, but it does it with great drama and great storytelling, and it's always entertaining. There is tremendous dynamic in the process of governing between the male and the female, and the military and the civil government. And what's interesting is all of the natural tensions when you try and govern between the military and the civil government are played out. And you really, if you want to, you know, forget going to government school at Yale, you sit down and watch the Battlestar Galactica or read Shakespeare, and you work through all the issues and the tensions of trying to balance between the various constituencies and their roles and responsibilities and ways of managing risk. You learn a tremendous amount about teamwork under stress and about how to organize both the explicit knowledge and the intuitive knowledge. And it comes back again and again to inventing your world, because here you've had an entire civilization almost wiped out. You only have 50,000 people left. You have to reinvent everything. You know, there are moments when it seems like, you know, that birth has died. You know, there's the death of birth, and you really are ready to give up on the possibility of survival. But you have to create, the leaders have to create and hold a picture of a new world that can be wonderful. And, you know, it constantly comes back, John, to this question of how you invent your world and how you nurture and create and grow a culture under incredible stress when, you know, you have a group of people trying to kill you. It's, you know, it's more than a metaphor for our current situation. And
yeah,
there's another issue that gets into, which I think is very, very important for living today, and that is we're watching a process where machine and digital technology is literally getting integrated into humans. So you're watching a production about a race of robots and basically artificial intelligence dealing and integrating with a race of humans, and the machines and the humans trying to figure out a way to get together and live together and do so in harmony or not, or extinguish each other, and all the different ethical and moral issues of that. And, you know, if you look at where technology is going, this integration of machine and human is a question before us, and that is explored, you know, throughout Battlestar Galactica in very, very interesting ways. So
I definitely want to see that whole series.
Yeah, what you need to do, what I finally did was I just gave up trying to order them from Netflix. I'll mail you the thing. You know, if you want me to mail you I have all the DVDs. I can just mail it to you.
Wow.
And, you know, you just watch one a night, a couple a week, and it just goes on and on and on. I mean, this is a major commitment because I think it was five or more years. But it's truly Shakespearean, and there is one great scene I have to tell you about that's a beautiful comment on the difference between, different approaches to both governance and sort of on male and female. At the beginning, the admiral is sitting and fighting this impossible war, trying to keep the Cylons from killing them. And he says to the president, who keeps interrupting him, you know, you've got to stop interrupting me. I'm running a war. And she looks at him and she says, Admiral, we've lost the war. We need to run away and get someplace and go have babies.
Wow.
And he suddenly looks at her. She's very commanding. And he realizes, oh shit, she's right. Now is not the time to keep fighting. You have to run. Anyway, okay, so that was...
I'll tell you, I once interviewed a guy, this would have been, I don't know, 1982, maybe, something like that, Ted Clark, who was a scientist working at Jet Propulsion Labs in Pasadena, and he was a hard scientist who was working on the Jupiter probe, I think it was called the Galileo, for years and years and years. And somebody tipped me to him and said, you should interview this guy, and maybe one of the local LA newspapers will publish it. So I went to his house in Altadena, a very interesting house, and he opened up these notebooks right away, and he showed me all the monuments of ancient Greece where he had led tours. And I said, well, why do you take people there? And he said, because that was a magnificent Renaissance moment in human history, and I want to show people what a Renaissance looks like because we're in another one right now, except we don't know it.
Wow.
And I said, well, explain. And he said, let me give you an idea of what a real space program is. And he said, the problem with the one that we have now is that the administrations change every few years, and then the funding changes, and the agendas change, and everybody has to, you know, reinvent the wheel. He said, let's say that you built these platforms that you could take out to the asteroids where you would mine minerals, and you would essentially build small cities, which you would then bring back to Earth. And on Earth, you would put domes on these, and each one would have maybe 10,000 inhabitants. And you would relaunch them and give them what's called a gravity assist that would take them out of the solar system, 10 of these, with 10,000 people each, all, you know, in their own world, literally, not communicating, with the idea that you would rendezvous at a planet that we have identified in a star system called Bernard Star, where we think there is a strong possibility that our kind of life could exist. And they would rendezvous there in, let's say, 10,000 years, and they would compare notes on the evolution of their societies. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, really? He said, we could do that. We may not have all the technology to do it now, but if the commitment was there,
we could actually do it. Well, if you listen to Gary McKinnon, we may be doing it.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other thing. That's right.
Yeah.
Ted was not, aware of any of that or privy to it, but this is what, you know, and then the conversation went into the uplifting of the human spirit because that was what he was really after when he talked about Renaissance. He said, human relations now take on a completely different view. And the human spirit takes on a completely different level of emotion. And he gave me an example. He said, during the Carter administration, when the gas prices were going through the roof and there was a deep recession and people were out of work, he gave a talk to a bunch of heads of construction companies. Nothing along the size of Halliburton or whatever, Bechtel. And he said, I got these people in a room and I talked to them about what we were doing at JPL. And I said, look, if we could go out into space and build orbiting hotels, 1982, would you be interested? And he said they went insane. It was like they had been, you know, led to an open door into a world they had never seen before that they had been waiting for unconsciously for many years, that had been cut off from them. And when he just alerted them to the possibility that the technology might be there to do it, it was like, well, this is what my life was supposed to be about.
Right.
It wasn't about money. It wasn't about going back to work. It was about participating in just the kind of thing that you're talking about with.
Right. It wasn't about living in a lower mind. It was about what a higher mind could do and what we could do together.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. We want to be.
Go ahead.
I'll never forget Robert Dean talking about sort of suppressed knowledge about what's going on in outer space. And he said, the thing that makes me angry is, he said, it is the birthright of the children to travel the stars.
Mm-hmm. And I would have to say that in the subconscious of many children, there is that suppressed sense that something has gone wrong. I'll tell you, because we're on to this now, in 1977, when Star Wars, the movie, the first one, debuted, in the morning, on a weekday, at 11 a.m. at the Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood, with very little fanfare, a friend of mine was there, and she said that when the initial text came on the screen, before the movie even started, in a galaxy far, far away, whatever, she mm-hmm. said the crowd in the theater went completely insane.
Wow.
I mean, out of nowhere. It was like the match was lit. This is the moment. Genetic memory and anticipation. It was like, this is what we're here for. Right?
Right.
Just like you say. Just like Robert Dean said. And I started thinking, once I started writing as a reporter, maybe, well, she told me that story about the time I started, I think, writing as the LA Weekly, 1982. And this really made a tremendous impression on me. And I looked back and I thought to myself, you know, 1976, Jimmy Carter, 1980, Reagan, maybe that was the last moment. I firmly believe that if some charismatic candidate had emerged to run for president in either of those years, on a platform of we're going into space, not we could or we should or whatever, but this is it. This is the future. This is what we're here for. This is what we can do. This isn't a pipe dream. And could actually sell it with all of the attendant, as you say, higher mind qualities that are quite real, and the higher spirit and energy and creation, imagination, et cetera, et cetera. That candidate could have been elected. And an alternative future would have taken place. Not without tremendous combat in the highest circles, mind you, but
right. It
could have taken off. People were ready. And then I saw that completely diminish and go away. Till now, it's a joke. It would be told as a joke on, you know, some ridiculous late night show.
Right, because the mind has gotten progressively lower.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it.
And what you're saying about all the resonance, the coherence of the machines and the gimmicks and the gizmos and the, you know, cell phones and the thises and the thatses. I mean, wonderful technology. Okay, great. Fabulous. But this is what it's engendering. It's not by and large. I mean, the people that are visionary when it comes to that new technology, what they're visionary about is basically computers. You know, it's like, I'm a computer guy and my vision is about computers, so don't bother me because that's what I do. I want more resonance. I want more coherence. You know, but actually, what we need are people to step outside of that and say, wait a minute. Let's think about this. What about that dream? Remember that dream? What happened to that dream? Think about what happened to it. Where did you put it? You know?
My favorite. Okay, so I get to pick my alternate movie, and I'll pick one just that addresses this. One of my favorite movies, because I love Ridley and Tony Scott. I just love everything that Tony Scott and Ridley Scott do. But one of my favorite is The Gladiator, which is the story of a Roman general who is done dirty. He is Marcus Aurelius's favorite general, and then Aurelius dies, the emperor dies, and his son takes over Commodus, and he gets done dirty, ends up as a slave and a gladiator. Anyway, there's a great scene where he's running out of the gladiator quarters into the arena, and he turns to the guy who runs the gladiator company and he says, "Marcus Aurelius had a vision of Rome, and this is not it."
Oh, yeah, I remember that. That's great.
I love that scene. This is not it.
This is not it.
And every day as I deal with understanding, you know, because as an investment advisor, you have to understand what's going on geopolitically. I hear that line almost every day. We had a vision of what was Rome, and this is not it. Because it's in such a lower mind. You know, the whole thing is in such a lower mind.
Yeah.
Anyway, let me quickly run through the movies that I had as runner-ups.
Okay.
And then you do the same.
Yep.
So here were my runner-ups. Number one runner-up was Longitude, which is a TV series. It was made from the book. It's about John Harrison, the clockmaker who invented the marine chronometer. And of all the efforts made to try and stop him from winning the Longitude Prize, even allowing British Navy ships to you know, lose their way and many sailors get killed. And you see again the, you know, this opposition to the man who can invent new things and invent his world, and the desire to sort of control innovation. It's marvelous. Another one is the Intelligence TV series, Canadian TV series. I always said The Wire takes you from the street level up through the police, and then Intelligence takes you through the intelligence agencies into the investment community, both the legal and the illegal. There's a lot of marijuana dealing. It's up in British Columbia and Vancouver. It's quite marvelous if you haven't seen it.
No.
Enemy of the State is, of course, for those of you who think that there's any privacy whatsoever, Enemy of the State is the movie for you to help you understand there is no privacy. The Gladiator, a wonderful movie about struggling in systems that have become, you know, expensively corrupt, and some very interesting comments. I knew in the 90s when they planned building all new sports arenas throughout the country, I said, uh-oh, here come the games. The Bourne trilogy I just love, and part of it is I love action movies. And you have something which is a picture of somebody who's lived through the system and found a way to live outside the system and his struggles to stay outside the system. Another one, I love Stanley Kubrick. I had as a runner-up Eyes Wide Shut, because it's the movie I use to explain to people that there is no government. And we do have this elite group who have the power to kill with impunity. And I think you really get a sense of that, and you can feel it in Eyes Wide Shut. Soylent Green, have you seen that one, John?
Oh, yeah, wow. Love Soylent Green.
The ultimate deterioration of the food system. Another one, a very British coup. Someone gets elected as Prime Minister in England who's really going to change the real policies and all the dirty tricks that are played on him to try and stop him. The International, which is a great comment on the international banking scene and how debt really works as part of a sort of this organization of control of places and harvesting of places. And then I had Margin Call, relatively new, but a great comment on where Wall Street is at this point. And for somebody who worked on Wall Street, I mean, you're there. That is exactly what it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
And then La Femme Nikita, the TV series, which is a primer. If you want to understand covert operations, you just watch all the Canadian La Femme Nikita. I guess it was Warner Brothers. It was U.S. 5.5 seasons of just, you know, one show explaining how covert operations work and sort of how all the double binds in the puzzle palace. It's very, very good education.
This is not the new one, is it?
No, this is not the new one. That's Nikita,
right,
I think.
It's doing it again now.
Right.
On Fox.
And then finally, of course, The Matrix.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I love the movie The Matrix is it shows you the power of even when all the data says things are hopeless, refusing to accept that and continuing to invent the positive forward and never giving up, and the power of that to change everything. So those were my runners-up. I have some documentaries, but let's hear what your runners-up were.
Well, I would certainly put The Matrix on that list because it. When I saw the movie the first time, I thought, okay, this is a great metaphor for what I'm working on here, because I'm trying to explain this in many different ways, how this operates. And here they're showing, you know, one guy in a support team who are completely dedicated to exposing what it is and then going beyond it, defeating it and going beyond it, which means, of course, that people have to wake up. And the scene between the, I can't remember her name, but she died not long after making that movie. The scene in the kitchen where she's deciding if he's the one. Would you like a cookie? You
know, the Keanu wise Reeves woman.
Sitting there.
The wise woman.
And, yeah, the wise woman. She's fabulous. And, I mean, there were enough of these kind of colloquial scenes to give you the sense of, you know, this is real.
Right.
It brings it down to earth. That this is an awakening, a process of awakening to this fiction that has been created. This painting that everybody is staring at and saying, this is reality. And now what we're going to do is show you that it's only reality because that's all you're looking at. Tremendous in that respect. 2001, Kubrick.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Same reason in a sense. But ultimately, the ending, the very surreal ending where Keir Dalea, the protagonist who has finally unhooked Hal the computer, goes through a series of rebirths and strange encounters as he becomes something completely more than he was before. And actually what he becomes is a fully realized version of himself who pops out of the Matrix. The entire space-time continuum matrix, in this case, to return to Earth and to see what it is that he wants to do now that he realizes that he's really been living through a series of kind of apartments. You know, I had that. I was renting that place, and then I rented this better place, and then that one was really weird, and then this one was mind-blowing, and then, wow, and then I'm now different. I'm now more of what I really am, and the only question now before me is what do I want to create, because I can do it. Then I would give you two Orson Welles, Citizen Kane and Touch of Evil. Citizen Kane on many lists is the greatest film of all times. Touch of Evil has been overlooked by many people, but it is the quintessential film noir, 1957, Charlton Heston, Janet Leigh, and a great supporting cast. And Welles, I mean, almost every frame is a magnificent black and white photograph, first of all. So no matter what the subject matter is, you're just riveted in looking at the screen, which is so much of what he really was about as director.
Yeah.
And the same with Citizen Kane. He's using something in Citizen Kane that never had really been used in films before called deep focus, where you could give a shot of a large amount of space, and what is in the foreground, whether it was, you know, an ashtray on a table, all the way to the small background character, would all be in focus at the same time, giving you a strangely super real version of reality. And then his low angle shots making characters larger and more dominating or more important or even more ominous were also fabulous and magnificent. And of course, the corruption exposed in the character of Charles Foster Kane in Citizen Kane, who is resembling William Randolph Hearst, is politically important, very important. But you see basically how someone who started out as being strong, alive, turns into someone who pursues power ruthlessly. This is what happens to the main character in Citizen Kane. And you see the twists and the turns and what feeds into that impulse for him to reject humanity, essentially, is what he's doing altogether. With no real goal in mind beyond that, except to accumulate power. But the thing about those two movies that, the reason I'm really recommending them is that, first of all, what was he, 25, 27 at the most when he made Citizen Kane? First movie. Never made a movie before. Got to Hollywood, and because of his reputation on radio and the War of the Worlds broadcast in 1938, he gets a studio to say to him that he has absolutely control over this movie, and he can do anything he wants. I mean, they don't even need to okay the script at age 25. And then he makes Citizen Kane out of nowhere. This is a creative, you know, genius, uh-huh. I don't like to throw around the word genius, but this is it. This is it in full flower. And just looking at it and seeing the way the characters play out and seeing what happens between them and the way he moves from scene to scene in the movie and seeing, you know, the space of it, the expanses, the way he manipulates space, the way he kind of turns characters into either sort of cartoonish versions of themselves if he wants to, or archetypes. He can do all that. He can just keep on doing it. He could have made that movie, would have lasted 50 hours, and I still would be watching it. And I also bring it up, finally, because he's a fantastic character and fascinating spirit in American history, Orson Welles. And you rarely get to see all of him in his later life because he was very cagey and he played things the way he wanted to. And, you know, I don't know that he ever really wanted to stay in Hollywood, even though Hollywood rejected him. Some people would say because of what Hearst did to him after the film came out, and there's some evidence for that. But Orson was always completely independent, and so he made movies in Europe. And he knew how to make them on a dime. And in every movie of his, there's something that just staggers you. Just to look at it, just to see it happening in front of you. Just to say to yourself, God, this is a different reality altogether, and yet it's more real than reality that I know. And so that tells me something about what can be created, what an individual human being can create. And I think that's the thread and the message that runs through all of what we've been talking about here. So that's it.
Well, it's one of the things you see just in our conversation tonight is the extraordinary number of very talented people who've tried to use the movies to teach us what's going on and what we can do about it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
There's a lot of Friends of Freedom sneaking through the vehicle. Well, John, as always, it's been a pleasure.
Wow. We're just getting rolling here.
I know.
After 2 hours.
What's our next conversation going to be?
I don't know. Novels?
I think we should do documentaries next.
Documentaries would be a good one. Yeah, I've got a long list of those. That might be a great one. Because there are some fabulous documentaries out there. In fact, I was an associate producer on one called American Addict, about medical drug prescription addiction, directed by my friend Sasha Knezev,
who I got to meet at your...
Exactly.
Filming at your house.
Exactly, Sasha. And that film will now be shown at the Seattle International Film Festival May, June of this year, 3 times, and we're hoping for a distributor, so... there you go, documentaries.
Okay, well, think about some documentaries. Yeah, okay, John, have a wonderful evening. Always a
pleasure.
You
too. Thanks so much, Catherine. This is just, I mean, talking to you is like, I'm in heaven. We haven't even touched on musicals.
We have to do a Cary Grant, Ross and Russell thing.
Yeah, right.
Okay,
ladies
and gentlemen, that's it. That's it for this week. Next week, Joe Mizak from Bloomberg just published a great new book, Encyclopedia of Municipal Bonds. The subtitle is A Reference Guide to Market Events, Structures, Dynamics, and Investment Knowledge. If you're holding municipal bonds, it's a great book. I recommend it. And then the following week, Precious Metals with Franklin Sanders. We have a luncheon coming up in San Jose on April 14th. So go to the luncheon section, and if you're in that area and want to join us, it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful sort of buffet brunch at a private home in San Jose. So until next week with Joe Mizak, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.